This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 9. This time I'm going to focus exclusively on Jim Conley. Jim Conley is at the very center of the murder trial of Leo Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan. And many people have picked at this particular point of the case that it really is a very important point, so it's worth dedicating the part that I talked about the last time and the things that I'll review this time. Jim Conley was the Negro sweeper at the pencil factory, and the point's already been made that one of two people murdered Mary Fagan, that it's most likely, unless there's some unknown third person or even more. But the two people that were known to be in the factory at the time when she came to collect her pay, and then later her body was found, are Leo Frank and Jim Conley. And the story that was established by the trial is that Frank killed Mary Fagan and then enlisted Conley to help dispose of the body. And this is what's disputed, that the people who, mostly Jews, who believe that Leo Frank is innocent, realize that in order for Frank to be innocent, Conley has to be guilty. And so they claim that Conley actually made up a lie, that he killed Mary Fagan and then implicated Leo Frank to save himself. And there is some truth, I think, to that argument, in that I think there's very little dispute that Conley was a liar and did lie to try and save himself. But I think that, as the facts we'll get into here demonstrate, and this all came up at the trial and it's all been rehashed many times since, that that still makes sense, that Conley tried to save himself, but that doesn't mean that Leo Frank was innocent and didn't commit the murder. So just to correct a point that a minor mistake I made the last time, I said that points 25 and 27 in the article that I was talking about, the 100 reasons that Leo Frank is guilty, I said that point 25 was redundant, and it isn't. And this shows the overwhelming nature of the details and the evidence in this case, and that I could, you know, eight half hours into this, could still make that kind of a mistake in reading those two points. And they were both about blood spots, but they were blood spots in different places. Point 25 was about blood spots found where the body was initially, where Conley said he found the body initially. And then another set of blood spots in point 27 was mentioned where Conley said he dropped the body at one point after carrying it a ways. So two totally separate sets of blood spots. Point 55 in that list, the very last thing I mentioned was that Frank partisans make a lot of Georgia Governor Slayton's 1915 decision to commute Frank's sentence from death by hanging to life imprisonment. But when Slayton issued his commutation order, he specifically stated that he was sustaining Frank's conviction and the guilty verdict of the judge and the jury. Quote, "In my judgment, by granting a commutation in this case, I am sustaining the jury, the judge, and the appellate tribunals, and at the same time am discharging that duty which is placed in me by the Constitution of the state," unquote. He also added of Jim Conley's testimony that Frank had admitted to killing Mary Fagan and enlisted Conley's help in moving the body, quote, "It is hard to conceive that any man's power of fabrication of minute details could reach that which Conley showed, unless it be the truth." In other words, the story that Conley told was so detailed that he didn't believe that Conley was capable of constructing a lie that detailed, that made sense. And that's, it's not just him that said that, that the jury sat through his testimony as well and thought, must have thought something along the same lines, that if they thought that Conley was lying, then they would have judged Leo Frank innocent. But they didn't. They judged Frank guilty. Now, in this list, and this should be the last of it, I think I've covered just about every point in the list, points 81, 82, and 83 make a point about, a collective point, about a special relationship that existed between Conley and Frank before the murder occurred. The fact that Conley's official capacity was sweeper, and yet he was paid $6 a day, which is as compared to $6.05 a day versus $4.05 a day, which is what the average of the white employees was, even though many of them were skilled machine operators and not just broom pushers. Another one of these 3 points is that Conley had been caught previously urinating on the pencils. And you would think somebody would get fired, especially a lowly sweeper that would be easy to replace. But he wasn't ever fired for that offense. And the third point of these three is that he wasn't required to always punch the time clock, that he seemed to be able to do that or not do that at a whim, whereas other people were held to account about that. In fact, the night watchman, Newt Lee, that was part of the initial attempt to cast him as being the murderer, was some manipulation by Frank of his time card to make it look like he hadn't punched his time card when he said he had. And a detail that came out during the trial that I don't want to get bogged down in. Now, the same person, Bradford L. Huey, I think that's how it's pronounced, it's spelled H-U-I-E, who wrote the article, this 100 Reasons Leo Frank is Guilty, that I've cited so much from, also wrote later in the year, later in 2013, in August through November, December, a series of articles that followed the trial in a serial form, boiling it down to what happened in the first week, and the second week, and the third week. And Jim Conley's testimony dominated the second and the third week of the trial. He was on the stand for who knows how many hours during those 2 weeks, but the cross-examination alone lasted 13 hours. So that gives you some idea of just how long he was up in front of that jury, that they got to do what a jury does, which is judge the person who's giving the testimony. So the article that Bradford Huey wrote about week two makes some interesting points about Conley. First of all, it stipulates that Conley had a criminal record and that he withheld the truth and even lied initially to the police and investigators, and gave several different versions of his story before finally the full version, the supposedly full version, came out in his testimony at court. And this is the way that it's described in the article. Prior to the trial, Jim Conley had made one admission after another under the withering blast of police interrogation. He would make 3 statements in all, in each one admitting to more and more participation in the crime. So, see, it's even I misstated that when I described it as, you know, that he gave several versions of the story. Well, he gave ever-expanding versions. It's not like one version totally contradicted the previous one, and he was making up totally different stories that didn't make any sense. He just revealed more and more of the story under pressure. And this is important because it makes sense as far as explaining what his mindset was as a henchman of Frank, and that had been established in the trial. It was one of the things that the prosecution established, was that he had performed special duties for Frank. it's my term, henchman. Despite the slow, reluctant, and grudging admissions and the obvious contradictions amongst his initial affidavits, investigators and even some who had been doubtful about Conley's account were finally convinced that they had gotten the full truth, or gotten the truth out of him. Police and factory officials accompanied Conley when he was brought back to the scene of the crime. Conley guided them through the factory and recounted and reenacted the events of April 26, 1913, the day of the murder, step by step, as he had experienced them. The account was so minute in its details, so consistent with the known facts, so precisely matched with evidence, which Conley could not possibly have known about unless he really had been there, and presented in such an open and frank manner that even skeptics were convinced by it. Now, Conley himself admitted that when he testified in court that he had admitted the story in stages, and that he didn't want, I'll quote him directly, it says, "I didn't want to tell it all." And he says that it was not the prosecutor that came and told him what story to tell. The prosecutor just came to get more and more of the details, kept pressing him for more, but didn't tell him what to say. Conley was cross-examined as well. He swore an oath to tell the truth, and the defense attorneys got full opportunity to question Conley. And despite that, he didn't. The jury must have seen that what he was saying was believable. And at one point, Leo Frank's attorney, Luther Rosser, referring to the recent haircut and clean set of clothes that Conley had been given, Snidely remarked, quote, "They put some new clothes on you so the jury could see you like a dressed-up nigger," unquote, possibly inflaming racial feelings amongst the all-white jury. It was widely believed at the time that Conley would be disbelieved by many simply because he was black and because Leo Frank, a white man, and Frank's attorneys would contradict Conley and accuse him of the murder. And woe be unto any black man in 1913 Atlanta accused of harming a white girl. Nevertheless, Conley, a simple and poorly educated man, gave not an inch on his most damaging claims against Frank, even when the most skilled attorneys money could buy cross-questioned him for more than 13 hours. I think that this point about the attorneys, and there were other times too when they used racial epithets in court, it shows how ruthless Jews can be when they're arguing their interests, and how ordinarily Jews posture against racial discrimination and intolerance, especially when it's aimed at them. When somebody is, when whites, for instance, are discriminating Jews from themselves, then Jews are against racial discrimination in that case. They don't want to be separated. But they are fully capable, as this example shows, of exploiting race when necessary. In this case, trying to play whites against the blacks in defense of a Jew. And at the same time in this trial that they were trying to encourage whites to feel this way about the black man, that he couldn't be trusted because he was just a nigger, they were also accusing the whites of being anti-Semites for putting being anti-Jewish for putting Leo Frank on trial. So they were more or less explicitly stating their own distinction from whites and blacks, and at the same time trying to get the whites and blacks, or at least the whites, to feel negatively about the blacks, more negatively about the blacks. The next article in the series focuses on week three, and in this article there's a quite a bit of detail here I have quoted, and perhaps I'll put it in the program post, but I won't read it all. What it amounts to is that the defense called many witnesses to try and contradict what the prosecution witnesses had said about Frank's character and about the circumstances of Conley being a henchman for Frank, working for Frank. But my reading of it is that it reminded me a lot of Stephen Goldfarb's argument. And if you remember Stephen Goldfarb, he's the Jew who wrote the article in 1996 titled Framed, where he argued a bunch of details about Harry Scott, the Pinkerton detective, and then leapt to the conclusion that, therefore, Leo Frank must be innocent and was railroaded. And the main mechanism that he used was he wrote a long article with lots of details and basically just clouded the issue, tried to confuse the issue, and in that, out of that confusion, jumped to his conclusion. And I see the same elements in the defense case at the time, at least as it's described here, as it's summarized in the descriptions that I've read about it, that they didn't really try to undermine or negate what the prosecution witnesses said. They just provided other witnesses that said the opposite. And the thing about that is that it's not necessarily incompatible. You can have one person who says, I saw something happen, and another person that says, I didn't see that happen. Well, that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. The likely resolution to that supposed contradiction is that it did happen. One person saw it and one person didn't. So that's one point to make about this issue. Another point to make is that what are the motives of these people that the defense called as witnesses in Frank's defense? And this is something where the Jews usually get a pass, because one of the motives that comes to mind immediately is that a lot of these witnesses, from their names and from their positions in the company and in management, were Jews. And so there was tribal loyalty at play there, and that they were Jews are willing to say whatever's necessary to exonerate their tribe mate. That's one element of motives. Others might have just been non-Jews who were employees, or maybe they were Jews too, but the fact that they were employees, loyal to their company, loyal to their boss, might have been part of it, part of the motivation for testifying in Frank's defense. And a third is that maybe some of them actually did buy into this white loyalty, the racial feelings that the defense tried to stir up, and that was another reason for testifying in Frank's defense, that they really didn't trust the nigger's opinion and had their own, that Frank was a good guy. But all of that, really, these witnesses that were called, is a distraction from a very key fact, which is that Leo Frank, who was the vice president of his college debate club, didn't testify, didn't swear to tell the whole truth, and instead just gave an unsworn statement and wasn't allowed to be questioned by the prosecution. So calling all these other witnesses in his defense doesn't amount to much when Leo Frank, the debate team member, wouldn't defend himself. Now, a comment on part five, the post that I made on part five, led me to Carlos Porter, because the comment said that Carlos Porter had examined this case and thought that Leo Frank was innocent. I think that's an interesting way to put it, too, because Carlos Porter puts the emphasis on the fact that he thinks that Leo Frank is innocent, but he doesn't say the opposite, which is that, or the thing that goes along with that, which is that, well, then that means the black man must have be the guilty party. He doesn't make much of an argument in that direction. He just leaves that kind of unstated. And they are separate, too. I mean, even I leave open the possibility that there was maybe some third person that was never identified that was actually the murderer. I think it's more likely that it was Frank, myself. But Carlos Porter seems fairly certain that it wasn't Frank. And so I want to examine his argument a bit. The comment actually included a link that I'll include to his argument, and this is what Carlos Porter writes. In my view, there is no real evidence against Leo Frank. And so right off the bat, that made me bristle right there. No real evidence against Frank is flatly wrong. There's plenty of evidence against Frank. There's what I think he's trying to say is that the only evidence against Frank is Conley. In fact, he says that in the next sentence. All the so-called evidence comes from Conley, the man who wrote the notes found with the body and who was convicted as an accessory to the murder. No attempt was made to imitate the victim's handwriting, but the police were supposed to find the notes, believe they were written by the victim during the commission of the crime, and throw suspicion on a, quote, long, tall, black Negro, unquote. Conley was short and powerfully built. The notes, well, before I go any further, let me address this point. So, as I said, what he's saying here is that all of the evidence against Frank came from Conley. This is very similar to Stephen Goldfarb's argument, which is that Frank was only convicted because Harry Scott testified against Frank. And Harry Scott testified against Frank because of Conley indirectly. That's part of why he became convinced that Leo Frank was guilty. But I think actually Stephen Goldfarb's argument was that it was Harry Scott that convinced Jim Conley to testify the way he did, that he fed him the lie. And that's essentially what Carlos Porter comes down to, too, is I don't think it's Harry Scott that he pins it on. He pins it on the police and the prosecutor as putting Jim Conley up to it. But there is other evidence against Leo Frank. There's plenty of other evidence against Leo Frank. And in fact, Carlos Porter actually points to it. He does a great service. He transcribed the governor's commutation letter, which is very difficult to read. It's available in its original form as scanned in PDF documents, images basically of typewritten pages. Very difficult to read because it's old typewriter. It's faded in spots. It's got crossings out and with pencil and some notes written. So he actually transcribed it into computer form. And in that document, actually, are several arguments that seem to me to contradict what Carlos Porter himself argues. The governor provides arguments that don't involve Conley as to Frank's guilt. There's no dispute. I'm not disputing that Conley was a major part of the reason that Frank was convicted, but it's debatable whether Frank could have been convicted anyway without Conley. I think it's possible he could have. That's a matter of opinion, I would think. Hard to say for sure. Now, Porter talks about the notes that were written, and in fact, this is what his argument centers on, is the notes. And he says, he makes the point that in his belief, it was Jim Conley that wrote the notes that were found on the body. And I don't think there's any dispute about that. Even during the trial, that was pretty much determined that Conley wrote the notes. But during the trial, what happened was Conley claimed that Leo Frank dictated the notes, told him what to write. And that seems to be unlikely. I would even agree with that because the language that's used in the notes is basically black dialect. It's not anything that an intelligent Jew would dictate. So I think the point is that Conley probably wrote these notes himself. That they weren't dictated. So essentially, it's another lie that Conley told several lies early on. The main one that I can think of is that he couldn't read or write was the initial big lie. But that this lie went essentially unchallenged and actually made it all the way through the trial, that the prosecution actually presented the lie that Leo Frank dictated the notes as the truth and supported that, at least. I don't know. You'd have to go back to the original testimony to judge for yourself how much they hinged it on. In my reading of it, is the case does not hinge on that fact. Whoever came up with the message in the note, and I'll concede that Jim Conley decided to write the notes and decided what went in them. That doesn't mean that Leo Frank was innocent of the crime. And the reason is this, that if we imagine, as was demonstrated during the court case, that Conley was a henchman for Frank, was a loyal servant to Frank and did what Frank wanted of him, ran errands for him, was a gopher for him, then the main features of the story that came out, that he helped Frank after the fact, that Frank had killed the girl and then got Conley to somehow get involved, that happened. But Conley then took it upon himself to write these extra notes, maybe because he wanted to do some – he had a brilliant idea himself, or what he thought was a brilliant idea, and wanted to blame another black employee so that for sure himself wouldn't be held accountable, and maybe even his boss, who he liked, wasn't going to be held accountable either. And it's also possible that Frank said, write some notes. And maybe even Frank did it maliciously. As I've mentioned before, maybe Frank put Conley up to writing a note or notes, said write a note, but didn't specify exactly what to put in the note. And Conley went off and did what his boss told him to do, because his boss had told him to do it. Didn't think too deeply about it. So, you know, either one of those are possibilities. And Carlos Porter doesn't seem to explore or even think of those possibilities. And that's I was disappointed to see that. He seems eager to jump to the conclusion that because Frank didn't dictate these notes, and he's convinced of that, then therefore Frank must be innocent. And I don't see the justification in jumping to that conclusion. It reminds me a lot of the OJ trial, that famous line about the gloves not fitting. And if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit, the black defense attorney said. And it was so ridiculous because OJ had struggled in trying to put on those gloves. They were obviously his gloves. They fit like a glove. They fit tight. But because they fit so tight, he made a big deal out of putting them on as if they didn't fit at all. And, you know, I guess it all depends, and that's the value of seeing the evidence presented in court and the testimony presented in court, that it depends on what the person sees as to what conclusion they come to, that hearing an account of it really doesn't cut it. But, you know, when I saw that live, I was convinced that he was just faking it and he was trying to make it look like they didn't fit. And then that convenient argument at the end that if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit, just because this one little detail of the evidence against OJ doesn't fit, well, that means you got to acquit him. No, it doesn't mean that. As in the Leo Frank case, there's lots of evidence against Leo Frank. And so just one thing being out of place does not make the man innocent. And I trust that the prosecution did their job properly, that they were honest and presented an honest case and weren't trying to frame Leo Frank. Carlos Porter doesn't give any real explanation for why they might have wanted to do that, except he says at one point, they convicted him to show that Georgia justice cannot be bought and sold with Jew money from New York. That might have been the attitude of some of the people around the trial. I don't know if you can say that that's the attitude of the prosecutors and the jury. That seems like a leap there, too. So, in a nutshell, I disagree with Carlos Porter. I disagree with his reasons. They don't make sense to me. I don't think Leo Frank was innocent just because some detail, one detail or two details, were out of place in the prosecution.